You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 23rd of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on the show, we'll be visiting bookshops in Barcelona, New Orleans, and Johannesburg.
It's a beautiful little converted old dairy, this. It was originally a dairy close on 100 years ago, and the space became available, and it's been perfect for a bookshop.
We'll also be hearing from David Ackerman, aka Mr. Pinks of Disco Discharge fame, to review some music from his compilations.
And we'll be joined in the studio by Thomas Weaver, editor of the architectural AA Files magazine, to hear what titles have been catching his eye.
All that and more coming up this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome back to Midori House in London, where it's about 4 minutes past midday. You're listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well. And you have recently been working on your own contribution to the culture, I believe.
Well, absolutely. Last time we were sitting here, I was just packing my bags and about to go off to Antwerp to cover the graduation collections of the Antwerp Fashion Academy.
And so you were.
Off I went, and I've now sort of done and dusted our film, which is coming out on Monday, and it was great. It was not only filmic, but, you know, when you get students from Antwerp, they really are kind of the more intellectual, rigorous fashion designers on the scene, and they're just very thoughtful. And I think in our film we've picked kind of four of the stars that are going to kind of make it big.
What caught your eye about the four that you lit upon?
Research, like unbelievable depths of research that they go into. So what you do is you see their portfolios, and they talk you through their portfolios before you see the collections. And it was really inspiring just to think the layers of thought and concept that go behind them. Obviously, you know, this is a school, this is graduation class, so it does have to be quite academic in their presenting 4 years of work. But then also at the school, you have to make your own garments really, 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 really well. You don't have, you know, teams of friends around you helping you. And I think the it was almost like engineering some of them. So I think we're going to be seeing them.
Okay. So you say it's released on Monday. Where and how can it be seen?
Well, what we do... We're getting it ready, and then we just we put it on monocle.com so people can go to the programs menu and have a click on the design section, or all our films are downloaded on iTunes. So
okay, so that'll
be take a look.
And what will it have an actual title?
Fashion Forward.
Fashion Forward. Okay, from Monday.
From Monday.
Excellent. It's now 6 minutes past midday in London. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
Well, now it's time to visit some small independent bookshops across the globe to find out what titles have been flying off the shelves where they are.
In the first place, we're going in South Africa, specifically to Johannesburg, where Kim Chakanetsa headed to Love Books.
My name is Kate Rogan. I'm the owner of Love Books. We've been open for 3 years. On Friday, the 8th of June, we were open 3 years exactly. It's a beautiful little converted old dairy, this. It was originally a dairy close on 100 years ago. And it's just a nice little old piece of Joburg that's been attended to and turned into something lovely. And the space became available, and it's been perfect for a bookshop. We've got sort of three levels, wooden floors. It's nice and warm. We're a general bookstore, but obviously we're small, so our bigger areas are general fiction, world literature, local fiction and non-fiction, and our children's section. Those are the sections that we sell the most out of and pay the most attention to. The community of the area of Melville, Parkview, that kind of area. As an independent bookshop, one of the fantastic things is that you can hand sell stuff. So the stuff that's flying out everywhere else doesn't necessarily fly out here. It's the stuff that we love that flies out. So I sold quite a few of those very quickly, and I'm reordering them. So that was very exciting. The other one is Hilary Mantel's Bring Up the Bodies, where the follow-on to Wolf Hall. That has also flown out for us. I've just started reading a proof copy of a title that's getting a lot of publicity overseas. It's called Tell the Wolves I'm Home by Carol Rifka Brunt, I think it is. And it's going to be fantastic. I started last night and struggled to switch the light off. So I'm very excited about that one. I think we're going to do really nicely with it. We do really well with local non-fiction, generally in South Africa and in our shop. So the one is 8 days in September. It's about the removal of Thabo Mbeki, the immediate 8 days before he was removed, and is written by Frank Chikane, who was minister in the presidency at the time. And that has done extremely well for us. And we've just received a new one called Who Rules South Africa? By Martin Plaut and Paul Holden. Paul Holden has done a lot of investigation into the local issues around the arms deal. He's done a lot of research for Andrew Feinstein, who's written books about it as well. And we're expecting that to fly out of here as well. The wine is my brother-in-law's wine from his farm, old family farm. It's been in the farm for about 300 years in the Paarl Stellenbosch area. The farm's called Justenberg. And we just thought books and wine are a wonderful mix. And there was my brother-in-law with an outlet just for him in Johannesburg. So that's we stock his range.
That was Kate Rogan of Love Books in Johannesburg. And I love the way we open the doors for these little bookstores. And I was kind of, I don't know if you noticed, I was looking in the International Herald Tribune today about France and everything that France is really doing to champion independent bookstores. And in fact, they're putting together a proposal where they're going to do things like try and limit the rent on rent increases on small bookstores. And they really are championing books and bookstores.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about things like that because it is, of course, in keeping with France's attempts to sort of, you know, brush back the tide in other areas as well, the sort of limits they place on the amount of English-speaking songs that be broadcast on the radio and the foreign terms that they will formally admit to their language and so on. I think the independent bookstores suffer, like a lot of sort of independent, small, quirky businesses of the sort that I know we champion here at Monocle 24, in that everybody likes the idea of them, but everybody would rather buy the actual stuff cheaper from a supermarket or online. I'm not really sure government...
Not always, but
I think, in the general run of things, I think that is the problem that these businesses face. It's how to actually get people to vote with their pockets. I do like the idea of bookshops being subsidised. I like the idea of books being subsidised. I have a vested interest on that front. But, so we're off next to New Orleans, where Eve Abrams went to Maple Street Bookstore, which is at 3141 Ponce de Leon.
My name is Matt Carney, and I'm the manager of Maple Street Bookshop in the Bayou St. John neighborhood of New Orleans, Louisiana. When we were about to open up, we were stocking what we thought would be, you know, books that we were really interested in, and we hoped that others would be as well, but there's no telling until you open the doors, and just there's such a positive response to what was available at the time was, I don't know, it really was nice.
It's real bleak, awkward.
We were doing a lot of books about mapping of information and space. So we had a book called Cartographies of Time, which is a really lovely collection of timelines across the ages. And that did very well as a holiday item. We had the Alexander McQueen Savage Beauty book, which is the Metropolitan Museum of Art collection. That was another one. Our bestsellers, when you look at it from like top items sold, are always going to be, say, like Hunger Games. And then lots of local titles like Lawrence Powell's The Accidental City did really well for us. We actually just recently did an event with the author, which went fantastically, and like that book's really caught on in New Orleans. When we're shelving our titles, we put the used and the new side by side with a small red dot on the spine of the used title instead of separating them out as some shops would do. I don't know, I think people more and more these days are just looking for a title to have, and it's, you know, for new and used, people are particular when it comes to gifts and the like. But it's just nice having everything available in one place and not sort of creating this subsection for used books, which I think also kind of creates a weird understanding of the value of a book being not necessarily the content within, but the condition of, which I'm not so crazy about. And also with things as they are, people are just looking for used items sometimes more than new. Just it's affordable. We do trade-ins. People can bring in old used books, and it creates... Back to the idea of like what makes this location special, and also what makes all of the Maple Street Bookshop's locations special, is that by doing this trade-in, of used stock, the shop starts to organically reflect the neighborhood it's within. So we have the items that are what people in the neighborhood have brought to us and what people in the neighborhood are taking from us. And you can also kind of envision these lovely little trajectories where someone takes someone else's book and is reading it and then encounters that person and they have a discussion around it. And I think that's really, it's the idea of creating the sense of community that bookstores serve as, I don't know, like almost like a megaphone for.
That was Matt Carney from the Maple Street Bookstore in New Orleans, where their shop motto is Fight the Stupids.
I do like a bookshop with attitude. I think that's an excellent motto for a bookshop. That's one of four branches, we should say, of Maple Street, which is why it's not actually on Maple Street, the one he visited. But it does sound like a cool chain, and they do sound like one of those bookshops which are trying to be part of their neighborhood. They're today and tomorrow, in fact, I believe, they're donating 10% of their sales to a charity which is raising money to rebuild bridges over the bayou as part of the ongoing repair work still being done on New Orleans years after Hurricane Katrina. But I do like Fight the Stupids. I assume they do. I presume they do T-shirts with that written on them.
I hope they're listening, because if not, it's a great idea.
Although if you actually were a member of dreadful Los Angeles in late 1980s skate punk band The Stupids, you could probably take that pretty personally. But finally, we head to Barcelona, where Monocle's man in Madrid, Liam Aldous, went to the Loring Art bookstore.
So my name is Ángel Loring, and I decided to open this bookshop in 1996. When I saw that it was a niche market in Spain for a specialized bookshop in contemporary art, I looked for a location near of MACBA, Museum of Contemporary Art in Barcelona, and this museum was opened in 1995. We were for many years the art bookshop point of reference, not only in Barcelona, also in Madrid and other cities in Spain. We were pioneers in design, photography, etc. We were and we are specialized in visual art from the beginning, including the first publication of fanzines and magazine. The idea was to offer the most very contemporary art. Right now, I don't know if we can speak about the book of the week. I think there are more seasonal hypes depending on what is going on. For example, now people is asking about Hopper or Hockney because of the exhibition in Madrid and Bilbao. Precisely, the books in the show window now are from a small independent publishing house that celebrates its 7th anniversary, and we really love it. We attract our clients through the professional places because our client, not, the idea was to attract the professional people working with art, as architects, designers, people who work in the museum, in the university, students, all people interested in art, also the tourists. At the same time, Barcelona is not a very big city, so it was easy to know the place through word of mouth. Also because at the beginning it was a very little bookshop, and little by little we expanded our bookshop and we had a mailing list. So in 2004 we can offer our website, and this was the best way to attract our target market. We always try to stay connected with what's happening in the city. We have relationships with other bookstores, fairs, libraries, and events, and we are always ready to organize presentations. We tend to make offers, parties, or collaboration with artists, but it's not easy right now. In addition, our self-published books or our import books are a good claim. Also, we interact with customers via Facebook, Pinterest, or whatever, as our website, for instance. We love to listen to the advice, complaints, or offer of our customers, too.
And that was Loring Angeles, owner of the Loring Art Bookstore in Barcelona.
And stay with us now, because coming up after this break, we will be going backwards through some disco music of various epochs. And later we'll be checking out our latest selection of magazines to review.
What does Mexico make you think of? Drugs, kidnappings, tequila and more drugs? Or how about a thriving economy, innovative business leaders, world-beating art, and the best in hospitality, and a rather good quality of life. As Mexicans prepare to elect a new president on July the 1st, next week on Monocle 24, we'll be going beyond the headlines and the stereotypes. We'll reveal a nation that international brands are desperate to crack, and where politics is vibrant and vital. We'll also reveal why you should put down that tequila as we investigate the Mezcal revival. Join us for Monocle's week-long Mexican survey on The Globalist and The Daily. Mexico 2012, next week on Monocle 24.
The Entrepreneurs is about finding the human face of successful businesses, meeting the men and women at the helm of enterprises with staying power, and handpicking the ideas that really matter amongst the hubbub. From international tech firms to setting up shop in your local community, we cover people-centred businesses, big and small, and gather a few pointers on how to strike out on your own along the way from the people who really know about self-started success.
Get big or die trying.
In the latest edition, The Entrepreneurs, we report on Tel Aviv's burgeoning tech community on the Med, attempt to reclaim the term luxury from the morass of market overuse with the brains at Interbrand, and talk to entrepreneurs from Hungary to San Francisco.
Building out tops, bottoms, shoes, you know, the whole wardrobe collection of what it means to live your life day to day and to give you that sort of canvas or uniform on which you can layer on other pieces. That's what we're about.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian DeBias, and Andrew Muller.
And it's time now for our weekly music review. And today we're staying in the UK, but leaping from London to Brighton, where joining us on the line is David Akerman, a.k.a. Mr. Pinks, from the Disco Discharge compilations. Good afternoon, David.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
To start with, tell us a bit about Disco Discharge. When did it start and why?
Well, it started in 2009, and I just thought there was a gap in the market for some proper, decent disco albums featuring proper full-length versions, you know, instead of the kind of usual best disco in the world album ever, which used to feature like 40 tracks and like 7-inch edited versions, something more serious for the, you know, the connoisseurs.
And it was, and those compilations you mentioned, like most compilations of most genres, tend to be retreads of the same 30 or 40 tracks over and over again as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, love them as I do. They're always Chic, Sister Sledge. You know, the various things. And you know, I just wanted to do something different because I knew there was a market out there for the people who'd been into disco for a long time and wanted to hear the full extended 12-inch versions.
Okay, and when you talked about sort of the disco connoisseurs and disco aficionados, I think that the thing is about disco, I think that it has that functional aspect at which there's, you know, at which level it's music for people to dance to, but I think possibly because of that, people sort of forget to perceive it as a genre which is an art unto itself. Do you think that's fair?
Absolutely. I mean, what people mostly forget, what people mostly think is disco is just a throwaway kind of, I'm going out on a Saturday night, getting drunk and, you know, having a dance around my handbag kind of thing. Where really, you know, I mean, a lot of disco, especially the early 70s stuff, they had like 48-piece orchestras involved. You know, so it was a very important type of music.
I mean, on your album compilations, you have some tracks never before released. Where do you find these?
Well, that's quite difficult, actually. I mean, the biggest part of putting the albums together is the research that's involved at the beginning. You know, to be honest, if I'd done it 10 years ago, I wouldn't have got the tracks I've got. With the internet and Facebook, you know, so many people are on there that you can find these people.
Why don't we have a listen to some of the music that you're bringing to the world? Can you introduce your first track for us?
Yeah, I think the first track is Susie Q. Mm-hmm. Am I right?
Yes, you are.
Yeah, can't live without your love. Yeah, that's an 80s high energy track from Canada, and it's just the archetypal high energy. Yeah, can you just imagine it pumping out speakers in some gay club somewhere?
Here we go.
I'm not afraid to
1980s high energy from Montreal, Susie Q with Can't Live Without Your Love. The first of three selections this afternoon by David Akerman, a.k.a. Mr. Pinks from the Disco Discharge compilation. David, that couldn't possibly sound any more 80s if it tried, could it? I'd be willing to bet money somebody involved in that was playing one of those keyboards that you wore like a guitar.
Absolutely.
What was it that appealed to you about that track particularly? It's an incredibly obscure selection. It was the brainchild of a producer called Jerry Cucuzela, who's not really troubled posterity since. Where did you find that one?
Well, actually, the guy Cucuzela is a brother of a guy called George Cucuzela, who's the owner of a massive, huge catalogue of disco and high energy classics from the 70s and 80s, based in Canada. One of the biggest things, they were involved with a group called Lime, who were huge on the gay scene in the early 80s. So to me, it's not that obscure, but to most people, yeah, I understand what you're saying.
I'm curious, when you go through all these back catalogues in your life, do you listen to only disco or do you listen to other music, David?
Oh no, I've got my taste is massively varied, so you know this is just the kind of my real passion.
And the other question, I was looking on your website, and I love the design of the album the CD cases, and I'm just wondering the pleasure you get out of that, and what design team you work with, and how you can come up with the ideas.
Well, the reason for that was I didn't want to put out a selection of CDs which had the usual kind of disco covers, you know, the kind of afro wig, the platform heels, the mirror ball. I just thought what I wanted was something kind of glamorous or something kind of that could fit but not actually disco.
And yet you say all that, but your next selection, which we'll get to now, is pretty definitive mirror ball disco. In fact, it's pretty definitive mirror ball chest hair medallions, polyester slacks and platform soles disco, isn't it?
Are we talking about Technique here or Tony Orlando?
At the risk of giving away the ending, we're talking about Tony Orlando here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, it is. The reason I chose the Tony Orlando track, one, I think it's awesome, and two, it was just, you know, this guy is the guy who was responsible for one of the worst records of all time, which is Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree.
It is certainly up there.
It is, definitely. And I just thought, you know, to go from that to this, I thought, you know, that's pretty cool.
Okay, well, Tony Orlando is still with us, interestingly. He did this was a post-comeback or post-retirement comeback sort of record, wasn't it? Because he retired to devote his life to God in 1977, as singers out of their mind on drugs often did during the 1970s before realising that that didn't pay terrifically well. And so he came back with this. This is about 1978, isn't it? This is Tony Orlando and Don't Let Go.
So happy I've got you here. Keeps me grinning from ear to ear. Ooh, wee. This feeling is killing me. Shucks. I wouldn't stop for a million bucks. I love you so. Just hold me tight and don't let go.
It's Tony Orlando with Don't Let Go, a record that could only have been made by a man with a moustache. Tony Orlando still performing in Branson, Missouri, incidentally, one of my very, very favourite places in the world, and I'm not even kidding. That's the second of three selections today from our musical reviewer, Mr. Pinks of the Disco Discharge compilations fame. That is extraordinary, that track. It is, as you correctly said, awesome. But what was it that particularly drew you to it?
I'm not sure, really. I think it was more to do with the fact that he'd made that dreadful record before. You know, it's kind of like, you know, that's such a brilliant disco record. But it's just like, how did that come out of that same person?
And yet, you know, Tie a Yellow Ribbon is, as he must surely know, and indeed wake screaming in the night thinking about, is the first line of his obituary, isn't it?
Absolutely, and it's probably the one that makes him the most money as well. He probably never gets any royalties from Don't Let Go.
How did you come by that track?
Well, I operate as I manage a Facebook page for Disco Discharge as well. And what I do is I ask the fans of the page, you know, if they've got any tracks that they would like to see included. And that was one of the one that came up time and time again.
So there is a weird sort of underground furtive cult following for Tony Orlando still.
Absolutely, but only for that record.
what is the rest of his sort of solo output like? Is it just one of those things? You do occasionally get these artists who just make this catalogue of absolute dreck, and therefore for one weird sequence, the planets just line up and they do something fantastic. Is this Tony Orlando's one great moment?
Yes, I think so. Before, he was a big star in the 60s as well, before Tie a Yellow Ribbon.
Indeed.
And then he did that, and that was like a worldwide smash hit, you know. And then after that, he kind of like disappeared into obscurity, but that was kind of one shining light in that obscurity.
It's extraordinary. Well, let's get to your final selection now. And this is a group called Technique, and there's actually been several groups called Technique or variations on the word Technique. So introduce this one for us.
Well, this was a massive record in the Saint nightclub in New York in the late 70s, early 80s. It's just the archetypal gay anthem, really. I mean, it was recorded in 79, I believe, but it was never really released till 82 after the kind of disco sucks movement that kind of kicked in. So it was only the gay scene that really took on to this record.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is Technique with Can We Try Again? Technique with Can We Try Again, the third and final selection from this week's guest music reviewer, David Akerman, a.k.a. Mr. Pinks from the Disco Discharge compilation. David, I read on the internet, so this may be entirely untrue, that was written by Muff Murphan, who was also culpable for Let's Do the Latin Hustle, a minor hit in 1976. Is that right?
That's true, yes.
Extraordinary. How did you happen across this one? Because you said it was recorded in the late 70s-ish, and indeed it sounds like it was, but wasn't a hit until 1983. Where was it in between times?
It was just kind of in limbo all that time, because, you know, you had the Kominsky Park Disco Sucks, you know, trashing disco records scenario in San Francisco and everything, and that record was produced just after that, so it was kind of like it was just a little bit after the moment. But then it got brought back in gay clubs, and it started in America and then got exported back into the UK.
So David, it's a Saturday night and you're based in Brighton, so I'm curious, is there somewhere you go to dance the night away to your disco tunes?
You know what? I'm a little bit old for that now. It's sad to say, but no. I mean, Brighton is full of clubs, but none of them are playing that kind of music. If they were, I would go. But most, you know, in Brighton, most of it's kind of modern, Beyonce, Lady Gaga, that kind of thing. And I'm a little bit old for that now.
David Akerman, a.k.a. Mr. Pinks of the Disco Discharge compilations, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. That was hugely enjoyable. You're listening to The Monocle Review.
A bit like a documentary film, but without any pictures.
There are some actors, there are quite a lot of musicians.
Festival.
Galleries. Bears.
You're cordially invited to tune in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. The show that wants to tell you about the music, art, books, films and media we think you should know about wherever in the damn world you've pitched your tent.
Some people collect shoes and other people collect Ferraris. I collect art.
In the latest edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds, we enjoy a live session from singer BT Wolf, and I report back from the 43rd Art Basel to hear what's been selling in Switzerland.
I think this year you can see that people are slightly more concerned about the economy. You have to get great works. If you have those, they'll sell.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24. To keep up to date on the latest issue of Monocle, new films on our website, products in our shops, and new programmes on Monocle 24, sign up for our free weekly bulletin. We'll tell you about special Monocle events and make sure you're ahead of the curve with all the happenings at Midori House. Just go to monocle.com to subscribe. Let's stay in touch.
Welcome back. It's about 20 minutes to 1300 hours here in London. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias.
And we're joined now in studio by Thomas Weaver, who is the editor of AA Files magazine. He's here to talk us through his publication and also to discuss some other titles that have caught his attention. And Thomas, it's lovely to have you here because we actually discovered AA Files a couple of weeks ago when one of our other guest magazine reviewers brought it to our attention.
Oh, really?
And we're suitably impressed. So, welcome.
Thanks.
And tell us a little bit about what AA Files is.
Well, AA Files is an architectural magazine, and it's produced and published by the Architectural Association, which is a school of architecture in the centre of London. A very old school of architecture, set up in the 19th century. And AA Files is essentially its sort of journal of record. It's a kind of the latest iteration of a whole series of magazines produced by the school since that time, since its founding.
Now, it's produced twice a year.
That's
so
right.
The curatorial approach is very important. I wonder if you can talk us through just, you know, the commissioning process and what you look for.
Well, it's produced twice, only twice a year because it's just me, in effect, who's doing it. So it takes a while to produce. And I've given a fairly kind of a free hand in terms of its editorial kind of tone and its character. But my own kind of training has been more academic and historical, so I've tried to make it a journal that basically features good writing about architecture from all over the world, rather than more of a kind of house journal promoting simply the activities of the school.
So give us a sense of the kind of articles that will be peppered throughout the pages.
Well, there'd be a sort of mixture. So there'd be some that would come from academics, so there'd be pieces about architectural history or about contemporary architecture, or there'd be practicing architects writing about their own work and about their own projects, or there'd be independent writers. But also it's understood, architecture is understood in a fairly kind of general terms.
No, I was just going to say this, I'm currently leafing through a beautifully illustrated piece which appears to be about the architecture of insects or something of the sort. A theatre of insects or how nature lost her morality. Which looks beautiful.
Yes. So, well, it's not a sort of trade. It's obviously not a trade magazine. It's not about architecture in a purely sort of bricks and mortar kind of sense. But that's partly empowered by the fact that the AA school has famously sort of understood architecture in the most sort of informal terms. I'm just sort of trying to kind of encourage good writing about the sort of visual arts or architecture in its, you know, in its most sort of expansive sense. So yeah, there's historical pieces, but there's also there's also pieces on photography, on philosophy, on art history, on music.
I mean, we have to describe just the look of this magazine, which in a way, every cover is just literally almost like a different colour, buff sheet of paper, a bit like an architect's sketchbook.
Yes, and that's partly a kind of response to the magazine. Before I took over, the magazine, like a lot of magazines, had an image on the cover, and it became a huge kind of bun fight as to, you know, the decision to put which image to go on the cover.
And it's one way of solving that argument.
So, but it became that everyone was more interested in the cover than the contents. And I wanted to sort of counter that. I wanted to make people read the thing and be interested in what's inside. So I made it deliberately mute, which caused a bit of a rumpus. But I think people are kind of getting the hang of it now.
So instead, do you just argue over what colour the cover's going to be?
Exactly. And it's actually not so much an argument. It's it's quite fun, actually. It's the very, very last minute. And sometimes the choice of colour is a reference to something that happened inside, or the season. I mean, I only produce one in the spring and one in the summer. One in the winter, sorry.
Because issue 63, which I'm clutching here, is a sort of russety, rust-coloured cover. It's very handsome, actually. Bronzish, I think. And what colour's that one you have over there, Gillian, 64?
It looks like a lovely buttery cream colour.
See, your spring and the chocolate brown is autumn.
And I can imagine, is the idea as well that arrayed in a sequence on a shelf, you would get a sort of pleasing, well, not the colours of the rainbow, but an effect of that sort, a spectrum, if you will.
Yeah, of course. But again, as lovely it is sort of as a tactile thing in terms of the surface of it, ultimately, as much as it looks good on the shelf, I want it to be something that's worth reading.
And what about the art direction? I mean, it's when you flick the pages, it's very rich and beautiful illustration, drawings, photography.
Yes, I work with a fantastically good graphic designer, John Morgan, who's based here in London in Paddington Station. His offices are directly above Platform 1 in Paddington Station. And John and I, you know, have worked very, very closely on each issue. And, you know, John's sort of aesthetic sensibility sort of taps into my own, so that we're making it, you know, that we're not afraid. In a sense, John's background is more in typography, so it's about simply the type on the page rather than the image. So you can see a number of pages in A files that is purely type. There's no image at all. And then other places when, you know, we do have nice images, we just put them huge, you know, across two pages. So you don't get that kind of meteorite shower of millions of little images interspersed within a text. So we have text pages and image pages, keeping them separate.
So when you're not working on your own magazine, what other publications get your attention and why?
Well, I should sort of also announce sort of this, that come clean to a certain extent, that I'm not a great magazine reader. I mean, just because I'm a magazine editor doesn't mean that I spend my life sort of immersed in the world of the magazine. There's too many good books to read. But I've brought along today four of the journals that are the only four journals that I subscribe to. And we can easily sort of go through those now.
They're spread out like a pack of cards on the table.
So we can pick a card. So the first one I brought along is one in a sense that was very important for me when I took over at A Files in terms of setting the tone. And it's the American Literary Quarterly, the Paris Review, which has been going since the mid-50s, 1950s, I think. And it was set up by the writer George Plimpton. And it basically features a whole kind of emerging generation of writers. But the sort of cornerstone of each issue is this great conversation it has with a writer. So these have been obviously going since the 50s. So there's a huge sort of archive of these conversations now. And the Paris Review actually produce volumes now of just the conversations. But I've totally kind of ripped this model off. And in A Files, I have one or two conversations in each issue. But it's the tone of the conversations in the Paris Review that I like so much, that you see in so many magazines now, the conversation form, because in a sense it's quite easy editorially. You record someone, you transcribe it, and you've got the content.
It was at one point a fairly popular thing, the idea of an author-led literary magazine. You say that was founded by George Plimpton, the sort of, I guess you could almost call him the father of gonzo journalism. He was the great sort of first-person reporter who, when writing about sport, would, you know, get into the ring and box people or try to actually make it as a football player, usually with somewhat bruising results. But like H.L. Mencken running the Mercury, I guess, as a predecessor of that. There's not that many examples of that still left. I suppose you could say Dave Eggers and McSweeney's would be the closest.
Yes, and then the new one is N+1, the Chad Hardback journal. Again, but in the States, much more than Europe, you find the sort of literary quarterly is much more of a kind of trope, I think, as a publishing. But even Paris Review even admit themselves when they produced their last issue, the 200th, they said, you know, these magazines should only really last for 5 or 6 years. And then they should die.
And except now, of course, they last forever. And you're absolutely right about their interviews with authors. Their website at theparisreview.org has pretty much the complete archive, which is an absolute treasure trove of, you know, every great literary talent and Nicholson Baker of the last 60 years or so.
But what's nice about them is that they are properly conversations. That again, when you see a lot of conversations in magazine forms now, they've clearly been sort of overwritten and sort of fudged to the point of the interlocutor is made to seem more intelligent than they are, or the respondent is actually polishing their responses. And with the Paris Review, I mean, there must be a degree of editing, but you still get the sort of hums and ahs and the sort of the rather banal questions and the rather kind of rough sort of distended answers. So it really kind of reads like a conversation.
It's like started in the 50s, but it still seems sort of very relevant without being gimmicky. It hasn't resorted to any gimmicks.
Yeah, and I think it also doesn't celebrate a kind of pantheon, like, you know, that it looks to always promote good young writers. I mean, but now when you look back on it, you see that those good young writers are the history of American contemporary fiction in the 20th century. But when they started, they were nobody.
What are you going to point to next?
Okay, the next one, and now for something completely different, is it's a magazine called The Blizzard, which is a football quarterly. I mean, physically, it's almost like the identical size of the Paris Review.
And almost as thick.
Exactly. And this is, I mean, I have a fondness for football, and I've always had a total kind of jealousy of Italians who are able to buy the pink Corriere dello Sport and read sort of informed or seemingly informed pieces on sport. And we've never had anything like that. Mm-hmm. And then this magazine, this journal, I mean, it's clearly, I don't entirely know the difference between a magazine and a journal, but this seems to be a journal, clearly sort of playing to that sort of market, that it's much more informed, kind of longer, engaged writing about football.
I mean, there's sort of a tradition in this country of, you know, I guess, highbrow, for want of a better word, writing about football. How does the Blizzard, would you say, how does it compare to something like When Saturday Comes, which I think probably more people have heard of?
Yeah, I think it is... They must have doing a nod to the Paris Review, because partly in the way that they divide up the magazine, they have conversations and they have interviews, they have historical pieces and they have contemporary pieces. So there is a sort of division within it. It isn't, in a sense, the fan as opposed to When Saturday Comes. In a sense, that's a sort of embellished version of the kind of fanzine in a
true,
way.
Absolutely.
And
true.
This is more of a kind of, you know, of writers. It's written by, you know, journalists who want to sort of stretch their legs a little bit more. I mean, the strange thing is that in certain reviews like the London Review of Books, which is going to be another one of my choices, very occasionally you get kind of Cambridge, Oxford dons writing about sport. But it seemed like so unusual, but I think the Blizzard sort of contains that a little bit more.
It is amazing in this, I mean, again, it's much more of an American tradition, that proper literary writing about sport, and it is amazing that so little of it exists in the United Kingdom. There's more of it about cricket than there is about football. But everything written, almost everything written about football, does seem to get herded towards the lowest common denominator very, very rapidly. People sort of seem to think that they must always be seen to be interviewing footballers, which for obvious reasons is usually a total waste of everybody's time. And assuming that everybody that's going to read it thinks on that level, which I don't think is how most people think about sport.
No, of course. And you're right in the sense that it isn't football, that Plimpton, again, who you mentioned, was writing about boxing and with Mailer too, you know, was
indeed
writing about boxing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's so much good literature in the States about baseball.
Which is much more interesting than the sport itself.
Exactly. But yeah, there is nothing on football, so that's why I just think it's rather interesting.
I'm mesmerised flicking the pages. I looked earlier on the website and I was trying to work out how they fund themselves, because I can't see any ads, and they were saying it's a kind of pay what you want system.
Yeah, I have no idea how they do it, but I'm just pleased that they do.
Possibly people do actually pay them. I mean, I think it is the thing, if you actually sort of pitch something like this to a sort of, again, for want of a less pejorative expression, highbrow middle-class audience, those are the sort of people actually more likely to think, oh, well, fair enough, I'll throw them a few quid.
Yeah, and I'm sure actually that the writers are just doing it on the back of commissions they have for their newspapers. So if they're going to interview whoever, some coach or player, the tape recorder is still running and they have to produce 500 words for the paper. Why not produce 5,000 words for a journal?
Indeed. And your next selection?
The next one is
not so much of the sports writing in that one.
No, occasionally. Now and again, this is the London Review of Books, which again is a kind of emblem to a kind of chattering classes in England. But it's a great, great journal. And for me, it's good just for the quality of the writing. You know, this is, you know, a kind of vehicle for consistently good writing, and also for the form of that writing, the essay form, which again is something that I've tried to do with A-Files, that I'm not necessarily pitching, despite the fact that so many of my writers are academics. It's not an academic journal in the sense that it's chapter three of whoever's PhD or their latest book, sort of mired down with footnotes. It follows that essay model, where, and this is exactly what the London and the New York Review of Books do.
It seems so many of these publications are not just for the reader, but also for the writer. And it's great, magazines like yours, AA Files, do the writers find that it's a unique opportunity for them to write the articles they've always wanted to write?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. But I think I don't want it always to be their, you know, their one great shot at their whatever their great love is. I also want to edit it properly too. I'm not a sort of copy editor or a proofer, that I really work with my writers in terms of trying to uphold that sort of quality of writing. And it would be the London Review of Books that would be the benchmark for that kind of quality.
You mentioned it as a sort of journal of a certain UK chattering classes, which it is. And I speak as one of those people who, I think, and it's going back a long way, but did I actually throw its infamous post-September 11th issue into the yard? I think I actually might have. Do you think it did learn any lessons from that? Because I think they had a flurry of brisk correspondence and cancelled subscriptions over that.
Yeah, I think it's at its worst when it becomes rather too mired in debate or a sort of earnestness of a kind of opinion. Again, it's also at its worst when it's stuck in a kind of Israel-Palestine kind of controversy. It's at its best when it's being funnier and cheekier and cleverer, I think.
And it does, of course, have that legendary personal ad section.
Exactly, which produced another book of its own, sort of collections of ads.
Indeed it did. And finally over there.
Finally is The New Yorker. Again, a sort of tremendous kind of benchmark journal that's been going years and years and years, and it's good in the because it's just people just buy it trusting that there's going to be one or two good things in it always, which is again what I want AA Files to sort of pitch itself, not at just a sort of professional market or people who are involved in architecture, but just people who are interested culturally in the visual arts and want to read something worthwhile. That, you know, I get my New Yorker and I flick through it, and if there's one piece, I'm happy. I don't read it cover to cover. But also, I think the level of criticism, you know, the literary criticism, the film reviews, the music reviews, the theatre reviews are all fantastically good.
At its best, it's very, very good. And it's a source of continual frustration to me that it's a model that never really has taken root in the United Kingdom, the idea of a sort of regular journal of long-form literary journalism. For some reason, there doesn't seem to be much appetite for that here.
Yeah, me too. I mean, weirdly, I think in England, it's the radio that covers that. Mm. I mean, you listen to Start the Week or you listen to review shows on Radio 4 and they are doing the job of The New Yorker. But you're right. I mean, it clearly seems to me a missed opportunity.
And it does also do some very, very great sports writing. In fact, they quite recently published a collection of New Yorker's best sports writing curated by the current editor, David Remnick, who's no mean sports writer himself.
Although, weirdly, it's one great sort of lacuna is architecture. I mean, they have wonderful critics in all of these different facets of the arts, but architecture, it's lousy.
But there we're getting into that ironclad rule of newspaper readers that you believe everything in the paper except the one story you know something about.
Yeah, maybe. But, you know, when I read, you know, reviews of a Norman Foster building and Norman Foster described as the Mozart of architecture, I throw the magazine away.
Well, on that note, thank you very much, Terry Savage, chair of... sorry, I was reading entirely the wrong piece. Thomas Weaver, editor of the AA Files. Entirely my mistake. I was a page ahead. Thank you very much for joining us to leaf through your favourite magazines.
That was Thomas Weaver. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24.
And that's all we have time for on this week's Saturday Review on Monocle 24. For now, it's goodbye for all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilboa and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Alex Jakes.
It's back over to Georgina Godwin with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 content on the curator after that. And don't forget, you can tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air Sunday at midday London time.
And you can catch up on anything you've missed on iTunes or on our website. But you've been listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian Tobias. Goodbye.